Yakel Moshe Eskoladas Bnei Yisrael Vayomer Alehem Eile Hadivarim Asher Tziva Adonai Lasososam Sheshes Yamim Teasem Elacha Uvayom Hashvi Yihyeh Lachem Kodesh Shabbos Shabboson Ladonai Kol Hosev Milacha Yumas Lo Sivaru Eish Bechol Moshev Hosechem Biyom HaShabbos. And Moshe gathered all of the congregation of Israel, and he said to them, "These are the things that God has commanded you to do. 6 days work shall be done, and on the seventh day it shall be for you holy, a Shabbat Shabbaton to God. Anyone who does malacha on that day, yumat, is subject to a death penalty. Lo tivaru esh, you shall not kindle fire, bechol moshvotechem, in all of your dwellings, biyom ha-shabbat." Now listen to how it continues, and I'll talk about it later. Vayomer Moshe el kol adas b'nei Yisrael lemor, zeh hadavar asher tziva Adonai lemor. And Moshe spoke to the entire congregation of Israel, and he said to them, "This is the thing that God has commanded, saying, dot, dot, dot." One more, and I'll explain it all in a moment. Vaydaber Adonai el Moshe v'el Aharon lemor, Zos chukas ha-Torah asher tziva Adonai lemor, Daber el b'nei Yisrael, V'yikchu eilecha fara aduma timima, asher ein bah mum asher lo ala aleha ol. And Hashem spoke to Moshe and to Aaron, saying, "This is the quintessential chok of the Torah that God has commanded, saying, speak to the children of Israel, and they shall take for you, or to you, a red cow, completely red, one that is totally blemish-free, and one that has not had a yoke put upon it."
OU Israel presents...
Come in. Welcome.
Shalom, and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. This show is for the double said Ra'av Ve'akhel and Pikud Day, and for Shabbat Parshat Para. Recording and first availability, Yom Kamishi, Thursday, the tone to 1st of Adar, 5778, corresponding, this year, to, March 8th. And now, here's your host, Phil Chernofsky.
Thank you, Zira. It's taken a long time to work on your pronunciation, but you're coming along nicely. And thank you for listening to Torah Tidbits Audio. I say that to every single person who is listening, and really to no one who's not listening. But I kid. Before we continue, let's do Tehillim Kuf Lamed, Psalm 130. With the understanding that it's the second time that I've done it today. I was at the cemetery with my brothers on 2 days after my mother's yahrzeit, Monday night, Tuesday. Monday night we had a gathering of the family for her 20th yahrzeit. And we weren't able to arrange to go to the cemetery on Tuesday. We arranged for this morning. So here is Psalm 130, Tehillim Kuf Lamed. Shir hama'alot mima'amakim kraticha Adonai. Adonai shima v'koli tehiyena oznecha kashuvot l'kol tachanunai. Im avono tishmor yoh Adonai mia amod ki imcha hasalicha l'ma'an tivarei. Kiviti Adonai kivata nafshi v'lidvaro hochalti. Nafshi l'Adonai mi shomerim l'boker shomerim l'boker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai ki im Adonai hachesed v'harbe imo fedut. V'hu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achinu kol beit Yisrael hanatunim batzara v'ashivya ha'omedim ben bayam uvein bayabasha. Hamakom yirachem aleihem v'yotzieim mitzara l'yirvacha u'me'afila l'ora u'mishibud l'gu'ula hashta ba'agala u'vizman kariv v'nomar amen. Okay, let's first go to the opening. The opening was the U.S. Army bugle call for assembly. Vayakhel Moshe, Moshe assembled the people. In the Midbar, we learn later in the Chumash, the call to assembly was the blowing of certain tones on the silver trumpets. On one of the trumpets, it was to gather the leaders of the tribes, and on both trumpets, it was to gather all the people. So I just used a more modern version of that. Not that U.S. Army bugle calls are so modern. But that was the call to assembly. Now, I read the whole first part. Let me go back and give some background here. There are 54 weekly sedras that the Torah is divided into. There are anywhere from 50 to 55 Shabbatot weeks. Shabbatot in a year, a Jewish year, depending on whether it has one Adar or two Adars, and depending on when it begins. Of those 50 to 55 available Shabbatot, one of them is always during Pesach, and one of them is always during Sukkot, in which case we have special readings. So you have to subtract two. Then there are years where either Rosh Hashanah is a Shabbat or Yom Kippur is a Shabbat, in which case you would subtract another one. Shavuot in our calendar is never on Shabbat. In Chutz La'aretz, the second day of Shavuot can be Shabbat. That's a whole other story. Let's not get into that now. So we're dealing with usually fewer available Shabbatot then we have weekly readings. Now, weekly reading number 54, the last one, Vezot HaBracha, is always on Simchat Torah. Here in Israel, that could be a Shabbat. Outside of Israel, it cannot. In any event, the numbers juggle around to come up with the following fact. Of the 54 Sedras, there are 14 that pair up, or seven pairs of sedras, consecutive sedras, that are sometimes doubled, meaning both read on the same Shabbat, and sometimes read separately. They have different rules. Not all double sedras follow the same rules, because they have different purposes. But by our sages doubling up, when they did, according to certain, let's call them formulas, it works out that we read the Torah once a year without any problem of going from the Shabbat after Sukkot all the way through till the following Simchat Torah. This year is a one Adar year, and there are a number of double sedras, the first of which is this week, Vayakhel and Pekudei. Now, it turns out that Vayakhel and Pekudei are very compatible with each other as a double. In fact, I think most doubles behave that way. And the practical side is that we need to accordion fold some of the Shabbatot of the year because we need to read more weekly portions than there are Shabbatot available. Now, Vayakhel and Pekudei, as I said, are very compatible with each other because the major overwhelming theme of this double Sedra is the Mishkan, the tabernacles, the first Mikdash, the sanctuary that we were commanded to make, and all of its furnishings, and the garments of the Kohanim and the Kohen Gadol, and the procedures, and a description of the actual erection of the Mishkan for the first time on Rosh Chodesh Nisan, the first day of the month of Nisan, almost a full year out of Egypt. Now, if you remember, and I've spoken about this on and off throughout the years, the parshiot of Teruma and Tetzaveh and the first third of Ki Tisa, a total of 236 psukim verses, deals with the command of gathering the materials and then using the materials to build a sanctuary and all of its furnishings and to clothe the Kohanim in their special garments for Avodah, the service in the temple. The picture that we get when we look at the sequence in the Torah is that after Revelation at Sinai, the day that we mark with Shavuot, the day we call Zman Matan Toratenu, the time of the giving of the Torah, was followed immediately by a period of 40 days and 40 nights, where basically the people were told, go back to your tents and be cool, and Moshe Rabbeinu alone will ascend the mountain in order for God to teach him all of the Torah. During those 40 days and 40 nights, we have a tradition that God would say to Moshe, the Torah, which you will write down whenever, I don't want to mention that at the moment, will contain the command to rest on Shabbat and to avoid doing melacha on Shabbat. You will explain to the people that that includes 39 categories of melacha and almost countless toladot, derivatives of those avot melacha, and this rule and that rule and this detail and that detail were to be transmitted orally to accompany the written words of the Torah. So we get a little window, a big window, into that period of time on Har Sinai, and basically we are presented two different types of mitzvah activity. One, the day-to-day civil law that governs society, that's mostly Parshat Mishpatim, and then we have the Melechet HaMishkan and everything involved with it is the other glimpse, large glimpse, that we get into the transmission of Torah from God to the people of Israel and then through the generations. I mentioned all of Truma, all of Tetzaveh, and the first third, approximately, of Ki Tisa. In fact, at that point, God is finished, even though there's many other things that he told Moshe, which we find out about later. Moshe was finished, and God was sending him down with the tablets of stone and with the teachings of the Torah, which he shall teach the people. But he was greeted by the fiasco of the golden calf, Chet HaEgel, upon which he either dropped or smashed on purpose the tablets and destroyed the Egel and castigated the people, and then went back up Har Sinai to continue asking God's forgiveness. And eventually he came down with the second set of Luchot and the message of forgiveness and the command to build the Mishkan, which he had received, and more importantly, we had seen, no, we continue to see in full detail in the Sedras of Terumah Tetzaveh in the first third of Ki Tisa. And then, after the two-thirds remaining of Ki Tisa deal with the aftermath, the Egel HaZahav and its aftermath, we find the double Sedra of Vayakhel and Pekudei, or the two Sedras of Vayakhel and Pekudei, have a tremendous amount of repetition of the details. It's 216 psukim that we're discussing. And the famous question is, why a duplicate set of details of the Mishkan, when it would have been sufficient to have the details once, and then to say, and Bnei Israel did as commanded, which the Torah, by the way, does say often in Pekudei, over and over again. And there's a question about all of this duplication. I have a mushal, a parable, an analogy that I've been using for many years. I made it myself, I think. I don't remember hearing it from anyone. And I'm sure that I've shared it over the years, both on Torah Tidbits Audio as well as in the hard copy of Torah Tidbits. But I like it, so I'm going to do it again. Maybe with a little bit of an upgrade. There are parents of an almost 15-year-old teenager. They realize his birthday is coming up in about 2 weeks, and they want to get him something nice, something special. They discuss it between themselves, and they both know that the kid really would love to have an iPad with a lot of different apps. And some of his friends have it, and he really expressed his interest in it and his desire for it. And they decide to go ahead with getting him an iPad. And they go to the local computer store, and they meet with a representative, and they tell him all the things that they want. And it's done. They bring it home, it's gift-wrapped, they put it in the back of their closet, and they're planning on giving it to the kid 2 weeks hence. 1 week later, they get a call to the principal's office of the kid's high school. When they get there, they find out that the kid is problematic in school, both in academics as well as in behavior. And they really didn't have an idea that this was happening. They kind of are shocked, or they express their shock anyway. And they ask the principal what he recommends. The principal says, I have an idea. I think even though it's expensive, you should get him an iPad. And make sure that it has, among other applications, some good educational programs in the subjects that he's weakest in, which will both capture his interest as well as help him get his grades up. They look at each other, then they look at the principal, and they say to him, guess what? A week ago, we bought an iPad, and it has all those programs and more that you're talking about, and we were waiting for his birthday to give it to him. So the principal says, don't wait. So the parents go home, and they wait for the kid to get home from school, and they sit him down for a very, very stern talk. And perhaps they punish him. And eventually, I don't mean too long thereafter, they get to give him the iPad at the principal's suggestion. And all of the programs that are on it. Now, he's sort of excited to get it, but he's sort of also a little nervous about the fact that his principal had called his parents in for a meeting and that reported that he was not doing well in school. Now, there's one thing missing from the scenario, and that is the parents need to tell the child at some point and really convince him of it that they had intended to give him that iPad before they knew anything was going wrong in school. The only way they could do it is by showing him the receipt and the date on the receipt compared to the date that they were called by the principal. And they tell him that he should now be faced with a mixture of the feelings of just joy at what his parents bought for him, mixed in with the remedial aspects of the iPad till he gets his grades up. As they say, Moshel L'mahadavar Domeh, which I'm sure if you followed it and I explained it well, maybe you figured it out already. The sequence in the Torah is that God commanded the building of the Mikdash and everything in it to Moshe to transmit to the people when he would descend the mountain before the episode of the golden calf, untainted by the golden calf. The background of the presentation of the concept of Mikdash and all of its details in Parshiot Terumah Tetzaveh and the beginning of Ki Tisah has the background of the Exodus, the splitting of the sea, and Matan Torah, the receiving and the giving of the Torah. That lofty background is where the iPad, or in this case, the two tablets, belongs. However, before Moshe had a chance to transmit this command, there was the fiasco of the golden calf. And that forever will color the concept of Mikdash. Why are we being commanded to make this of gold and plate that with gold and put gold here and gold there? Because it is an atonement for the golden calf. We made a graven image, a terrible, terrible sin. God now commands us to make graven images, namely the Keruvim, the cherubs, on the lid, the kaporet of the Aron. And that's part of an atonement, part of a repair, a tikkun. And the same thing with many, many other aspects of Mishkan. We, the people, will never be able to see Mikdash without its immediate background of the sin of the golden calf. Except for the fact that God put it into the Torah with all of the details after the episodes of Matan Torah, Truma, Tetzaveh, first part of Kitisa, before Cheto Egel. You need both perspectives. And the way to get both perspectives is to duplicate the full detail. Because the alternative is to make one detail, set of details, and the other, they did like that, ditto marks, and that won't work. We need to be able to think and ponder about Melechet HaMishkan on two levels always. One, lesser one, as remedial for the poor performance of Cheto Egel. And the other, the lofty, exalted, ecstatic feeling of a pure gift of that which will bring the people closer to God and God closer to the people. That's why we have 236 psukim of Melechet HaMishkan in Truma Tetzaveh in the first third of Kitisa, and we have another 216 psukim in Vayakhel and Pekudei. Next, both the 236 psukim presentation as well as the 236 as well as the 216 pasuk carrying out of the commands, in the one case are followed by, and in the second case are preceded by, a reminder of the supremacy of Shabbat. At the end, after the 236 psukim, God tells Moshe to remind the people that Shabbat is supreme. Building the Mikdash, which is a very lofty task, cannot supersede Shabbat. The functioning of the Mishkan does, but that has another aspect too, which I'll get to in a moment. But the building of the Mishkan is not done on Shabbat. Shabbat, interestingly, is referred to as Shabbat Shabbaton, a term which we think of in terms of Yom Kippur. But the commentaries explain it like this. When we have six run-of-the-mill, mundane weekdays of activity, and we abstain from activity and rest on the Shabbat, then that seventh day is called Shabbat. But when we are involved for 6 days of the week in building the high spiritual task of the Mikdash, in order to forge a closer relationship between God and the people, then resting from that is on a higher level and is referred to as Shabbat Shabbaton. Now, speaking of Shabbat and Mikdash, we can summarize in a few ways. Shabbat represents sanctity of time. Mikdash represents sanctity of place. Our existence in this world is in the three dimensions of space and in the fourth dimension, or the dimension or dimensions of time. And therefore, between Mikdash and Shabbat, they hold hands and cover the whole concept of our challenge to make our life in this mundane world more spiritual. And they represent it in a lot of ways. Furthermore, that which was considered creative activities in building the Mishkan, became the 39 categories of forbidden creative activities of Shabbat. Again, because they walk hand in hand. There are twice in the Torah, a pasuk, which says, Et Shabtotai Tishmoru, my Shabbats you shall keep, U'mikdashi Tirou, and my sanctuary you shall revere, Ani Hashem, I am God. Equating them further. Now let's zero in at one of the pesukim from the beginning of Vayakhel, and that was Lo Tiva'aru Esh B'chol Moshvotechem B'yom HaShabbat. Do not kindle fire in your dwelling places on the Shabbat day. The Karaites, those who took only a literal explanation and understanding of the words of the Torah, those who rejected the oral Torah and tradition of Torah Judaism, sat in the dark the entire Shabbat and ate cold food. They were commanded by the Torah not to kindle fire, so they did not use fire for light and did not use fire for cooking. We say we may not kindle fire on Shabbat, but our tradition is that we prepare for Shabbat by having lights already lit, in modern times set on a clock to go off and on whenever we want, and the same thing with a plata of Shabbat to keep food warm for Shabbat, because that is how God wants us to enjoy the Shabbat, not eating tuna fish out of a can in the dark. So on the one hand, you have Lo Tiva'aru Esh, B'chol Moshvoteichem, and in the place, capital P, namely the Beit HaMikdash, fire was used to light the menorah, because that's not Moshvoteichem, your places, that's the place. But the Shabbos candlesticks represent the statement against the Karaite literal interpretation or literal explanation, and their light, which they give off, symbolizes how Shabbat is supposed to be spent, notwithstanding the Lo Tiva'aru Esh. Or to put it a little differently, the laws of Shabbat, the halacha of Shabbat, were not meant to suck out the joy of the day. They were meant to guide us to a more spiritual kind of joy that Shabbat is supposed to be. And that means we have to work on it and make the Shabbat a special day. Simply by saying, not allowed to do this, don't do that, don't do that, don't do that. Okay, so I won't do anything. Not it. The laws of cooking on Shabbat, baking on Shabbat, are very strict. The details on how to provide you with warm food on Shabbat could have gone in the way of saying, you know, too easy to violate Shabbat. Let's play it safe and not turn on the stove at all. And our sages said, no, that's not what Shabbat is supposed to be. Shabbat is a day of delight. A day of delight needs light and warmth and warm food. And therefore, Chazal, our sages, went out of their way to be very detailed as to how to bring about that aspect of Oneg Shabbat without, God forbid, trampling or even stepping on any of the halachot. So a lot of times when you review some of the details, you say, look at all these things you have to remember, and look at all, do you think it really matters? And the answer is it does. When you look at, I'm just picking, not at random quite, but I'm picking one little piece of the Shmirat Shabbat Kehilchata, the book on Shabbat observance. You have halachic permission to set a Shabbos clock. Okay, so here is my lights in my living room, which are on as Shabbat enters, and at 11 o'clock at night, they go off. And at 9 o'clock in the morning, they come back on, or 3 in the afternoon, whatever, and they stay on for the rest of Shabbat. Now picture the following. You're in the middle of dinner with friends on Shabbat, and you really, really had a nice time, and it's getting late. It's already 10:45, and the lights are going to go off in 15 minutes, and you're not ready to bench, and you're not ready to finish the meal. Is there a way to prolong the lights to stay on? The answer is yes. It is possible, halachically possible, under many circumstances with many types of Shabbos clocks, but not all, to postpone, to do what is necessary in a mechanical way, to postpone the shutting off of the lights. You cannot make the lights go off earlier, but you can prevent them from going off when they were supposed to, and they'll go off an hour later or whatever. Now, that sounds picky, except I believe we need to appreciate that our sages throughout the generations, until and including the rabbis and authorities of our time, that they will not play fast and loose with halacha, but they know halacha so well that they're able to guide us in accomplishing many things that we can. If it turns out that you want to do something on Shabbat and it can't be done, then it can't be done. The only thing that would push aside the laws of Shabbat would be a life-threatening situation or a possible life-threatening situation. But there are plenty of other situations where, with the right knowledge and guidance, you can accomplish certain things that would enhance the Shabbat. Let me make this very clear. If the circuit breaker flips and you're plunged into darkness on Shabbat, you pretty much have to do the best you can, and you're not going to get those lights back on. Don't want to discuss now whether you can ask a non-Jewish neighbor to help, or a Filipino that a neighbor has, or if you don't, whatever. There are ways to do it, but there are also, the bottom line could be, you can't do it. You mean to tell me God wants me to sit in the dark? No, he doesn't want me to sit in the dark, but if that's the situation, then that's my way of showing my commitment to Shmirat Shabbat. I had a fellow in the army who argued with me about Shabbat a lot. He said, you mean to tell me that it's better to walk to shul 15 minutes on a sweltering hot summer morning, get to shul soaked in sweat, and then pray to God in that kind of mood, when I could take a 5-minute ride in my air-conditioned car and arrive at shul like a mensch and be able to daven pleasantly? And my answer was, yes, you're not allowed to do that. Yes, it's better to walk for 15 minutes in the sweltering sun than to drive a car on Shabbat, which is forbidden. And if you say that that's taking away your oneg Shabbat, what you need to do is work within the accepted proper guidelines of Shabbat and maximize your comfort, but not to step on any of the laws of Shabbat. I will say that, except for a song which I will look for to end the show, I think we're going to have to call it a day. I didn't tell you before, but I lost solid 10 minutes when I accidentally hit the stupid mute button on my microphone. And I have to either get a microphone that doesn't have a mute button or figure out some way to protect this from accidentally being pressed. I would apologize to the button for calling it stupid, but I don't believe the button has any feelings, so I will satisfy my feelings by referring to it as a stupid button. On that note, well, not really that note, I didn't get a chance to talk about Parah Aduma at all. We'll have to save that for another time. I would like to wish you a Shabbat Shalom. You know, not enough. Let me go and say a few things about Parah. We're in the middle of a period known as the Arba'a Parshiot, the four portions. Arba Parshiot, the four special portions. They span at least 5 weeks, if not six, this year six. We started with Parshat Shekalim on the Shabbat before Rosh Chodesh Adar. Then there was a Shabbat that was a break in the sequence. Then there was Parshat Zachor before Purim. Then there was another break the day after Purim, last Shabbat. And now we have the last two Parshiot in a row, Parshat Parah and Parshat HaChodesh. The reason that our sages put Parshat Parah right before HaChodesh is HaChodesh commands us mostly on the Korban Pesach, the Passover sacrifice. And in the time of the Beit HaMikdash, it was at the beginning of Nisan that it was most common and most important for the average person to go through the purification processes, which are facilitated by the ashes and the potion of the ashes of the red heifer. And therefore, right before we read at the beginning of Nisan, or right before Nisan, about Korban Pesach, the Shabbat before, we read about the purification process. Now, the Haftorah combines with the Maftir to point us in two different directions when it comes to purity. We purify ourselves as individuals by going to mikveh, by counting out the certain number of days of ritual impurity, either one day or 7 days. In the time of the Beit HaMikdash, some of it was accompanied by bringing of korbanot at the end of the period. And in the case of Tumat Mate, the ritual impurity from contact with a dead body, there was the potion of the Parah Aduma. I'll leave it as what I called it originally, the quintessential chok, because that's what it is. A chok is a mitzvah that does not lend itself to understanding it on a level of common sense and reasonableness. It's something that when you look at the details of it, you go, huh? But you hold your head up high and say, I do this mitzvah because God commanded it. Yeah, but what sense does it make? I am finite. only God is infinite. And I need to spend the rest of my finite life asking questions, studying, and getting answers to those questions. Always with the possibility that I won't succeed in understanding it, because I am finite. But sometimes you get an excitement when you do understand something, at least on your level, and that enhances the practice of the mitzvot. And that's why a person has to spend his lifetime trying to understand more and more about what God commands us. Always with the basic feeling of, I trust God, and I am willing to do things that he commanded them because he commanded them. I don't need a reason. I'd like a reason. I want to look for a reason. I want to understand things better. But my commitment is on that basic level of I trust God. And on that note, I will wish you a Shabbat Shalom, l'hishtameah.
Ki yeshmera Shabbat, kel yishmereini oti le'omeyad, beino uveini oti le'omeyad, beino uveini oti le'omeyad, beino uveini. Asur metzoh hefetz, asoterachim, gam miladaber bo, divrei tzerachim, divrei zchora, af divrei malachim, ege betorat kel, utechak meini, oti leomeyad, beino uveini, oti leomeyad, beino uveini, poem tzatamid, nofesh lenafshi, nei ledor rishon, Natan Kiddoshim, Ofed B'Teit Lechem, Mishneh Bashishishi, Kacha Bechol Shishi, Yachbil Mizoni, Oti Leomeyad, Beino Uveini, Oti Leomeyad, Beino Uveini, Rasham Bedat Hakel, Chogel Seganav, Ola Roch Lechem, Panim befanav, al ken nitanot bo, al pi nevunav, asur levad miyom, kippur avoni, oti leomeyad, beino uveini, oti leomeyad, beino uveini, hu yom mechubad, hu yom tanugim, lechem yayin tov, Pasar vedagim, amitam limbo, achor nesonim, kiyom zemachotu, utesam feini, oti leomeyad, beino uveini, oti leomeyad, beino uveini, mechel melach abo, sofo leachrit, al kenach abes bo, Libi kevori be'et palela elkel Arvit mishos rishavim Musaf egam mincha Uyar meini Oti leomeyad Beino uveini Oti leomeyad Beino uveini